Welcome to Butterflies and Bravery.
Yay!
I am one of your hosts, Jemima, and my co-host, Whisper. And today we have Janice with us, and we are going to hear some of her story. So, Janice, tell us a little bit about yourself. I'm really excited to hear.
I was so tickled to receive an invitation. I'm really happy that you guys invited me on. I have heard your show before, and my background was one of a little bit more mainstream Christianity. So I'm Canadian. I live in British Columbia, and I was raised in a Pentecostal home. So my parents would speak in tongues and anoint us with oil and that sort of stuff when we were sick. And that was just normal, just part of life. And we had a TV set in our home with a lot of restrictions on what we could watch, but still we had a TV, and I went to public school. But I knew that things in my family were different than things in others. And I was very much the goody two shoes. So the teachers loved me because I was very responsible. And I think the kids found me a bit more of a pain, because if anything was going down, I'd be telling the teacher, we got to follow the rules. And part of my need to follow the rules is because my dad was very fundamentalist Christian, also is a narcissist. And so he was quite volatile emotionally and occasionally physically. He wouldn't hit us, but he would punch his fist through the wall or do that kind of thing, which is terrifying when you're just a little kid and your dad is a big, scary, powerful person. So I learned, and my siblings learned fairly early on, that there could be safety in following the rules. If we could learn the rules, we wouldn't incur his wrath, unless, of course, he changed the rules. So I was a real rule follower from early on, and I just wanted to please my parents. My dad was particularly unkind to my mom, and so I really wanted her to have an easier time. And I was the youngest of four kids. I was actually the youngest of three kids, but in Canada in the 60s and 70s, unfortunately, we had something called the 60s scoop, where our police, the RCMP, and social workers went on to our Indian reservations, the reserves where Indigenous people live, and they stole the children away, and they put them into white Christian homes. And so that's how my sister came to live with us when I was 4 years old. Just a little Indigenous girl showed up at the front door with a suitcase, and my parents said, "This is your new sister." And yeah, that's a whole extra thing. And what's really been very hard on our First Nations people in Canada. So that's just a little side bit. My parents moved us to New York in 1976 so my dad could go to Bible college, because Jesus told him to. That's in air quotes for people who can't see that. Jesus told him. But of course, he just would have made a terrible pastor, because he was such a narcissist. And so he didn't really make it past the first year there. And then he was quite offended when we came back to our town in Canada, and the pastor didn't immediately want to make him associate pastor or vice pastor or whatever you would call the second in command there. But yeah, narcissists are hard to work with. So he was an angry man. And my siblings all walked away from religion essentially in their teens. And I saw how it really wounded my parents each time one of them did. And I said to myself, I'm never going to do that. I'm never going to hurt mom and dad that way. So I really doubled down. And I had a brief time of backsliding. There's my air quotes again. In my late teens for a couple years, but then I was back to Jesus in my early 20s and more than ever. Just really was glued to Jesus. My whole life was about Jesus then, when I moved back home, moved back in with my parents and started going to my old church again, and the pastor introduced me to a young man that he thought would be a suitable match for me, this fellow who was very nice, who wanted to become a pastor. And so we got married, and that was the trajectory that we were on, was him becoming a pastor. And we moved away to a small town on the prairie provinces so he could attend Bible college. And that's where things really got weird, even weirder. I would see these women in town, and they had head coverings on. So their hair was always covered, and they were dressed in very modest clothing. And I said to my husband at the time, do we have Amish here? And he said, no, those aren't Amish. Those are, that's a type of Mennonite. They're just doing what they're supposed to do. The Bible actually says in the New Testament, that's how women are supposed to dress. And I was shocked because I hadn't taken it seriously in the New Testament. And I asked him for his permission, my husband at the time, for me to start veiling, I would call it veiling.
Oh, wow.
I called myself the Lord's veiled handmaiden.
If
that's not ostentatious stuff, oh my God, get a hold of yourself, woman. And so I didn't know how to sew because I wasn't a real Mennonite. So I had a glue gun though, because being a good Christian, I did do a lot of crafts, arts and crafts. And so I had got out my glue gun and I glued fabric onto some headbands that I had. And because sure enough, it did say in the New Testament that women were supposed to keep their hair covered and to dress modestly, to pray without ceasing. So to me, that meant I should always be covered then if I'm always to be in an attitude of prayer. I took it very seriously, but I never preached it to other people or insisted that they, I was usually the only one wherever we were that was dressed like that. I looked like I was right out of Little House on the Prairie. But my husband said at the time, because he wasn't the one that insisted I do this. Again, it was my comfort with following them. He would say to me, you're making your circle smaller and smaller. How small are you going to make your circle of what's allowed, what's acceptable? And I just thought that, frankly, he wasn't very holy. And so it was up to me to do it all. And he did get a job pastoring in another prairie province, and we moved there. And it was quite difficult, bordering on terrible. And then we had a series of about 2 years where just everything went wrong. It was calamity after calamity befalling our family. And here's me thinking I'm living as close to the Bible as I possibly can. I'm trying to be charitable, being merciful, being the best pastor's wife I know how to be. I'm homeschooling the children. I'm trying to do everything. And then we didn't stay in the pastoring job. We moved back to our hometown. And the shitstorm, pardon me, it just kept coming. Every bad thing kept happening. And then our youngest daughter was diagnosed with a life-threatening illness and a lifelong illness that she would not recover from. And she's still alive. But it's a scary thing. And that really, that was what snapped me out of it. That just broke through my cognitive dissonance at that point. I was like, I must have bet on the wrong horse. I felt certain there was a God, but it must not be the Bible that was the right thing. And so I started to give myself permission covertly to start exploring other religions and other belief systems. We stopped going to church. My husband was in quite a depression after the pastorship didn't work out. The kids were confused. We'd been moving here and there since they were little. I think that was hard on them. And then our youngest daughter got sick, and it just was so hard. And so I set up camp in the New Age territory for a while and decided I let myself explore all these things that were forbidden. And I would go to psychics, and I would say my mantras, and I had crystals, and I grew dreadlocks, and I just went from one extreme, of course, straight to the other. My poor kids must have had whiplash. Like, what is going on with you, lady? They had a front row seat to that gong show. And then I ended up...
Did you say a front row? Did you say a front row seat to that gong show? G-O-N-G.
That is exactly what I said.
That's fantastic. I don't think I've ever heard that gong show.
That's what it was. Oh my gosh, it was so crazy. And then... But I did ask my kids at one point, I'm like, you girls have seen mom go through so many changes, and what do you think of it all? And they're like, well, you're a lot easier now. You're way more fun as a mother than you were before. And what else could they say? Now I know. Now I have an idea how deep some of their own religious trauma from all that stuff is, and family of origin trauma. But I was exploring the New Age world. And then eventually I found out there's dogma. There can be dogma in the New Age world too. And people were really pressuring me to, oh, have you ever do you pay attention to this person in the New Age movement and that person? And this one can channel these beings from other dimensions and all this stuff. And I was like, oh my God, I just left this bullshit. And now you're trying to tell me over here that there's more of it. And I was going back to school also to become a registered professional counselor in Canada. Mm. And I was still trying to piece together what the heck had happened to me. Mm. And it's like all of a sudden the bottom falls out of your universe and you are in free fall. What I thought was up was down. What I thought was down was up. No one else I could really talk to. I didn't know anyone who'd been as devout. I loved Jesus so much. He was my best friend. He was my cosmic big brother. He always had my back. God was always behind the scenes working out everything for my good. And then suddenly, no, that's not true. There's nothing. What's true? What's real? What else am I believing that actually is a lie? It was really hard. And so I just recognized that somehow people who had been stuck in cults and then managed to leave, we had something in common. And I didn't think that my Christian Mennonite and Pentecostal beliefs, I didn't think it was a cult, but I saw that we had this in common. So I just studied what I could about cults and cult recovery. And I eventually had the great fortune of seeing Dr. Marlene Winnell online in an interview. And Dr. Winnell wrote a really important book called Leaving the Fold. And I recommend Leaving the Fold for anybody who's left a fundamentalist background. And finally, here was somebody putting words to what I had experienced and what I was feeling. And so I phoned her up. I found her phone number and I gave her a call, and she was in San Francisco. And she said, I'm having a retreat in a month. You better fly out here. Come on up. So I did. And I was freaking terrified. I had never, as an adult, left the country. Like, I hadn't gone on my own anywhere. And I was thought, what if this is a cult? What if I'm flying and I could go meet these people and they're going to kidnap me? I just had no idea. And of course, that didn't happen. And I got out there and there were maybe 15 or 20 people. And all of them could relate to my own pain and grief over losing what was so dear to me and having to start over, all over again, to build a secular identity, losing relationships. And my marriage, I lost my marriage. We were together nearly 20 years and I lost my religious community, and some of my family members were still religious, and it made for a sticky stew. It was just a hot mess sometimes, and to have people understand was really helpful.
You said you all lost your marriage. Was that because, pretty much strictly because you left Christianity?
I think that really hastened it along. We married because we were both deeply religious. He didn't become religious until later in his teens. I didn't have a choice. I was steeped in it from the time I was born. So we had different feelings towards religion. My whole personality, my everything about me came from being raised in a religious home. My personality didn't have a chance to develop apart from how my parents thought I should be and the religious leaders thought I should be. And also, we're just very different people. And I think he's on the spectrum a little bit. And that can be really hard if you're a very intensely emotional person, as I know I can be, to be with someone who doesn't have the words or the understanding really to grapple with that. It just was a hard marriage to be in. And then he lost his dream of pastoring. And then suddenly I'm this different person. I become like a completely different person overnight, I'm sure it felt to him. And we're still reeling from how our family was changed from our daughter's illness. And we went bankrupt in there, and my nephew was put in prison for murder, and my parents divorced. It was all everything in a very short span of time. So yeah, the marriage didn't survive. But what I can tell you is we are much better friends today than we ever were. We are still very close. We talk to each other quite frequently. And I've recently remarried, and my new husband is quite comfortable with the family dynamic, knowing that the father of my children will be invited to our big events that we have. And it's actually turned out really well.
That's great.
That was part of it. Yeah. Yeah. I'm quite lucky, I think. Yeah. So then meeting Marlene was incredibly helpful. And then because I'd gone back to school to become a counselor myself, I was starting to really recognize some of my own trauma. And then after a few years, I started specializing in really taking an interest in religious trauma recovery. And I said to Marlene, that's Dr. Winnell, is anyone doing conferences about this? And she said, no. She said, I think you should do it. And never having been to a conference in my life, I said, sure. Like a crazy person. If you're ever having thoughts that you want to put a conference together, just call me. I'll talk you out of it. It's a lot of, it's a lot of work. So the conference on religious trauma was born, but I was aiming for it in 2020. And by then I'd been living with the fellow for a couple of years, and he was quite computer savvy and tech savvy, and he had done lots of conferences. He was never religious. And so he helped me set up the website and stuff, and he set up the payment system, and I was selling tickets for the conference on religious trauma. Everything was going great guns. And then all of a sudden, the pandemic. And so I had to cancel the conference, and he was working out of town at that time. And I was trying to call him because I was so devastated, saying that I had to cancel this conference, and he wasn't answering my emails either. And then I get a message from him, and he says, basically, I can't do this. It's not working out between us. Goodbye. And I was like, what? And then I found out he was still married to his other wife. He had a family there, and then he had a family in my province with me. And then when I went to try and pay back people, he had been taking the money from the account for the tickets. And then I got an eviction notice because the landlord said, you were late with the rent twice last year. I didn't know that. I was so trusting. I had always given my money to my partner that I didn't know was dishonest. And he had been late giving the money to the landlord. So now in the middle of the pandemic, we're evicted, me and my daughter as well. And so 2020 was a very hard, very terrible, hard, awful year for me as well as for lots of people. And then here I am in 2022. I own my own place. I have a new husband. I'm just living such a beautiful life. I did put on the conference on religious trauma in 2021, made it an online event. We've just had our second one in 2022. And now in October, we're doing the first ever Shameless Sexuality Life After Purity Culture online conference. So, ta-da! Wow. Life is beautiful.
That's amazing.
That's so wonderful.
That's quite a story. It feels good to be on this side of things. That going through it was pretty awful. And I had so many kind people who knew what was going on, because of course I was tracking down, trying to send refunds to everybody who had bought tickets, and they were just so kind and supportive. And it meant a lot to me. So your kindness can go a long way to people. You never know.
Yes. Very much. So your podcast that you're starting is also on religious trauma. Is that...
It is. Yes. It's called the Divorcing Religion Podcast. So I'm on Twitter as @WiseCounselor and also @DivorceReligion. And originally when I started it, I wasn't sure how comfortable I was, whether I wanted to be publicly identified. And also I wanted to explore what it would be like if people never saw my photo and they couldn't tell by my name. What would it be like if I pretended to be a man? And to me, that meant if I posted things as aggressively as I wanted to and didn't use emojis and didn't soft pedal stuff, if I really just gave my opinion. And it is funny, to this day, even though I have the two accounts now, people can see who I am, and I even tell people that I'm the same person. Many people mistakenly think that I'm a man posting on Divorcing Religion just because I don't hold back. And so I also developed the Divorcing Religion Workshop online, which is a 6-week program. We get together every Sunday morning because you're not going to be in church and talk about our journeys, our deconversion journeys. And then I made that workshop to reflect the stages of a marital divorce, because, of course, I had divorced my husband at almost the same time. And so it talks about who introduced you to religion, because that can actually be really an important thing. Who introduced you, and then what was your breakup like? And we look a lot at the grief process, because it's a lot when you lose your entire worldview, as you ladies both know. And then it talks about plenty of fish. Who? How are you going to be? What are you doing to try and figure out your belief system now? And building new community. What does it mean to build a safe secular community? How are you going to do it, especially in a pandemic? Mm. And then the last module talks about avoiding falling into fundamentalism again. How can we avoid that? Because we, even though we maybe have left our cult or our religion, we can still be thinking in very black and white terms, really rigid, very comfortable with authoritarian thinking. So this is something that we need to keep in mind as we're building our new life. So that's called the Divorcing Religion Workshop. So it just made sense when I was starting my podcast to call it the Divorcing Religion Podcast. And I'm inviting all of my speakers from the Conference on Religious Trauma, and then I'll be inviting all of my speakers from the Shameless Sexuality Conference as well. And I'm opening it up too to other people who have left religion. I want to know what their background was and what was the hardest thing about leaving and what helped the most in their recovery, and then a surprise question or two at the end. So far, it's being received really well. We haven't even officially launched it yet. I think we'll launch it with Seth Andrews, because he's a pretty well-known fellow, a thinking atheist, and people always want to know what Seth has on his mind. But I have some really big name guests as well from the field of religious trauma work.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm also very busy. Got so much going on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Keeps you busy, huh? For sure. There's a whole lot to learn and a whole lot to unlearn.
Yes. And of course, I'm still building my private practice as well. So I still do the one-on-one religious recovery consulting with folks. And I have clients from all around the world, but mainly in the United States. Lots of them have come out of evangelicalism, but I also have worked with folks who have left Orthodox Judaism, Islam, a lot of former Catholics, former Jehovah's Witnesses, independent fundamentalists, Baptists, just a lot of people who've been really harmed by religious ideology. And now they're trying to figure out their life moving forward.
It's a lot to figure out.
It is. And particularly when people are still married to a spouse or they're raising children and they still believe, that's a really big deal.
Yeah.
And or if they, in America, I hear from a lot of young people, say in their 20s and 30s, whose parents now are members of QAnon. And so there's just this massive wedge that's happened in the family. And these people are wondering, is there any possible way to salvage the family relationship? It's a really hard time for a lot of people.
That's difficult. I can't even really tell my parents that I'm not a Christian, because they will not receive it. Yeah. My mom knows, but my dad is, and he never even was in the cult, but...
Wow.
I told him once a long time ago, and he just got so upset. And now he's always, oh, you still pray. You still believe in Jesus. But I just don't answer him.
Quietly. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, how about that weather? Yeah.
Exactly. Talk about something else. Some people just will not even accept the fact that they should possibly look at their beliefs and re-examine and see if it's still...
What
you believe, even.
Oh, and in fact, the one thing we must be ruthless with and around is our beliefs, particularly when we are likely to build our entire lives on those beliefs. That's why, to me, the truth and radically accepting reality are very important. Hmm. And so, yes, some people choose not to have those discussions with family members. Some people want to get it out there right away. We do refer to it pretty much as coming out because that's what it is, because you don't want to have to keep pretending. And so we tend to keep quiet about it until our need for authenticity outweighs our need for acceptance. And at that point, when we're tired of hiding, it's really, especially if you're living in the same place and you see them all the time and they're like, why aren't you at church and this sort of thing? There does come a time when there's that need for, this is who I am, and I invite you to love me how I am and as I am. You don't have to embrace my beliefs, but you do have to accept that this is what I believe. That's your price for admission to my life.
I like that. That's good.
Yes.
Yeah. I tell my clients that parents remain in our lives by invitation only. And family of origin remain. Once we're an adult, they're in our lives by invitation only. And we are allowed to rescind that invitation. We have to be willing to leave the table when respect is no longer being served. So I tell people to take care when they're considering when is the right time to tell their parents or their loved one that they are no longer a believer in whatever it is that they believe. If you're living with that person or you're tied in financially with them, you need to make sure you have some money set away. You need to make sure you have a safe place to go. If things blow up and get violent, you must take safety precautions. Have someone that you can talk to. Have a secular therapist, that you can talk to about these things, because you really might need some help with this, because it's a lot. It's probably impacted your view of sexuality and gender roles and all sorts of things. And you may suffer really low self-esteem, poor self-esteem. If you've grown up in a religion that's always told you you were a useless worm and you're nothing without Jesus or whoever, need to work on some of those beliefs. And it is very possible to have a beautiful and fulfilling life after religion.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And my kids, my daughters are grown now. They're in their 20s and none of us are religious now. My mother is the only one. I'm estranged from my father now. I felt that was the safest for my mental health, and still quite close to my mom, but she is still a believer. So she knows the work that I do is completely about religious trauma. And she says, my religion is just wonderful. Nothing about my religion is traumatizing. And I'm like, you did stay married over 40 years to this narcissist because God hates divorce. Air quotes, God hates divorce. So I would say that's pretty damaging. But so we just tread lightly, my mom and I, because we do love each other so much and we do like to be as close as we can be and go on little trips together and just get together. So since, I mean, she's in her 80s, I don't want to be causing her existential crisis at this moment. I want her to slide into home plate just feeling deeply loved. And if she's on her deathbed and wants me to hold her hand and sing Amazing Grace, I may choke on those words, but I will do that for her.
Yeah.
Because I want her to feel comforted, and she's near the end of her life. It would be very different if she was my sibling and we were close in age. Then we would be having pretty significant conversations, I think.
Yeah.
I totally get that.
Yeah, because you don't want to just live for the future. If you're putting off today for the sake of tomorrow, guess what? You might get hit by a bus. You just have no idea what could be coming your way. Let's embrace reality. Yes. Let's be radical about accepting reality as it is, not as we wish it was. That's why people are trapped in miserable jobs, miserable marriages, hoping things will get better or Jesus is going to reward me one day. No, bullshit. You have to, if you're miserable, make a change.
Yep.
That's what's required. No one's coming to rescue you. You must rescue yourself.
Yeah. It's interesting that you talk about that, because there's a mindset that a lot of people like need religion to be able to deal with what's going on with their life or what's to cope. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Over the last
few years, I went through some pretty intense things and pretty intense losses, and including deaths. Mm. And I actually found not having religion was so much actually easier to deal with some of those things, because it wasn't like, God, why? And what did I do wrong? There was none of that. It was like, this is a beautiful life that unfortunately, whatever happened, that they're not here anymore. And that it was just, like you said, embracing reality. It actually made things easier to
I'm so glad.
Like, see that. Yeah. But I do know that what you said, it's like sometimes, how do you cope? That's probably a big question that people ask you, I imagine, and you're like, what do I do for comfort? Who do I talk to? Like
that, dear. Yes, that actually, even within the last week, I had someone else ask me that. I used to be able to, when I was feeling unsettled or anxious, used to be able to pray about it. And this person has grown children, and they're saying, what do I do now? I can't pray for my kids. And when I lay my head down at night, I still have all the worries. Whereas it used to be, just give it all to Jesus before you go to sleep and he'll take care of it. And I get it. I do understand that. It was such a bitter pill when I determined that no God exists that I know of, not the God of the Bible. And that was so, like, after my warm, fuzzy fantasy of religion that I had, it was like a bitter, cold slap in the face, water in the face, however you want to put it. And it took me really a while to find my feet again and get comfortable with that and with the idea that whatever I need in life, I can somehow get it. There are smarter people than me. There are more experienced people than me. I know how to book a therapy appointment. I know how to talk to a financial person to help me with my budgeting or whatever it is. I don't need to depend on Jesus. And that every time I was praying to God and my prayers seemed to be answered, I was actually praying to myself, just talking to myself and figuring things out as I was talking. And so I encourage people, if they're struggling with the idea of what do I do with my anxiety, you journal, you write it down, you go online and do some research, you join a support group, you contact a secular therapist. If you're worried for your children, you talk to your children. I love you so much, and here's a concern that I have, and have you pondered this, or what do you think might happen if blah, blah, blah. You talk to them about it in real time. You don't need a made up intermediary to talk to. You can actually talk to the person and really embrace that this life is fleeting and it's so random. Mm. So when something wonderful happens, we must celebrate it. And when something sad happens, we're allowed to mourn it and to be sad about it and to write about that and talk to people about that. But it doesn't mean there's some grand design and everything is going on just the way that it should. No, when a child dies of cancer, when an innocent person is taken by someone else in a violent way, there's nothing good about that situation. Yeah. Life just sucks sometimes. Terrible things happen because, not because the devil is making people do things, but because some people are mentally ill and because some people just make very poor choices. Some people are just not right and they make those choices and they affect other people. So instead, let's focus on how much good can I do in the brief run that I have? How many people can I love? How can I express that love? How can I help the planet and help other people? And that's one of the reasons I'm doing the podcast as well, because I want to reach people that maybe they won't be able to attend the conference on religious trauma. But you know what else? I also just started a YouTube channel, and that thing is free. And that's where I'm putting old sessions from the inaugural conference on religious trauma. I'm posting them there for free, because I want people to have access to that information.
That's awesome.
That's amazing. Yeah.
That's good.
Thank you.
So wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a shock when you grow up thinking that life is one way.
Yeah.
And it turns out not to be the way that your parents and authorities told you this is the truth. and you're a child and they're telling you this and you don't have any critical thinking skills to evaluate whether it's right or wrong. And all the people close to you also believe that this is the truth. You take it in and psychologically put booby traps all around that so that you're not even going to poke at it. If there's a string hanging off it, you're not going to pull it because that thing might unwind. So that's where we try and protect ourselves. And that's also why it's so hard then when the end of belief comes.
Yeah.
It was really hard for me to accept because I married a non-Christian after I left the cult. And I was always like, oh yeah, this, that. He was like, what? No. It was terrifying, actually. Because I was like, oh yeah, what about the plagues in Egypt? And he's, yeah, that was like an earthquake happened, a volcano went off, and that's why the plague came, and that's why this. And I was like, oh, no freaking way. Back then, they didn't know that this volcano hundreds of miles away is what's causing all of these things to happen to you. So yeah, it does seem like acts of God. But yes, now we're informed. We know that's not the case. And it's
science.
It's hard, yes. It's really hard to accept when you've, that's your whole life sometimes. And like you said, everything is built around that.
Particularly the older you are. I was devout until I was like 40. That's when everything for me really just fell apart, when my beliefs dissolved, basically. And then I had nowhere to hang anything. It's like here, if your skeleton dissolves, there's nowhere to hang your whatever. Nothing makes sense anymore. Yeah. It's the dissolution of your entire worldview. And so that's also why we have to grieve that loss. And life is divided into before and after. It's like when you lose a loved one.
Yeah.
Or when you lose a marriage, when you lose your religious beliefs and your entire worldview. But you still have to keep going out to work. Your boss doesn't care. Your boss is like, well, so what? You don't believe in Santa Claus anymore? Get back to work. So that's why we really need to connect with other people who can support us and who understand what it's like. And there are specific types of grief even that really impact us when we are recovering from religion. And there's no body to mourn. So this is something maybe if someone died in a plane crash or someone was kidnapped, the loved one doesn't have a body to bury. That's a specific thing. And then there are also losses that you're not allowed to mourn those losses. Say if you were in a covert love affair with someone who was married for many years and that person dies. Well, you can't really let people know. Or women who've had an abortion, and sometimes that time of year comes around and they're quite melancholy, but they can't really talk about it. So this is why we do need to be able to talk to other people who can relate.
Yeah.
Yes. It's very important to, so you have to replace, you can't just remove, you need to bring in something else that will make sense to you. And so that you can have something to hold on to still. I mean, learn that yourself, that you are your own savior.
Yeah.
That's like the conclusion I came to, because for a long time I just sat there daydreaming that somebody was just going to come and save me. And I found out recently that a lot of people feel that way. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Your brain kind of sits there and tells you a knight on a white horse is going to come and save you. You just need to wait. And then one day you're like, wait a minute, I'm my own knight, I'm the own white horse.
That's right. You save yourself.
Yes, you have to
save yourself. Yeah, or you remain unsaved. And that's a very big deal, particularly when you've been raised to feel less than, when you've never been allowed to take pride in any accomplishments, and it's a sin to be proud of anything, particularly in Christianity. Believers are kept in a somewhat of a stunted mindset, a childlike mindset, because that's how you're supposed to be. That's what faith is all about.
Yep.
Little children believe in Santa Claus and Superman because that's what they believe in. And they're, because parents aren't saying, no, that's not real, this sort of thing. So yeah, for us to have held on to our beliefs for so long and then find out, wow, that's not actually how it is. I'm so glad that you're married someone who could tell you honestly what reality was about history and science. And people, we need to be so kind to others who are just coming out of that fog, of that intense being under the influence. And that's how I treat people who are very religious. I treat them as if they are under the influence, because if they knew the truth, they would not be behaving in the way that they're behaving. So it doesn't help anyone to say, it took you long enough, or why do you believe that bullshit in the first place? What people need to hear is, I'm here for you. If you want to talk, how can I support you? Yeah. Do you want me to help you find a counselor or a therapist? That's what people need.
Yeah. Interesting enough for me, I actually think I pretty much lost my faith in religion while I was actually still in the cult, which is really unusual. I had wanted to leave, so it wasn't like I was devout to the cult, but I just remember one day, because we had all these freaking like requirements and things that supposedly Jesus was requiring of us, and I had 4 kids in the space of about 6 years.
So I just had
all this row of little ducks that there was a point in time where half of them were not potty trained, or it was just a lot. And this some new edict came out where, oh, if you haven't had X amount of Bible word time within the group, then you don't get to see the weekly video. And there was a picture of a weekly movie, and there's a drawn picture of Jesus saying to this woman, I gave my life for you. Can't you give up something for me? It was just, and that's the moment where everything just crashed for me, because I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? Wow. If this God can't like fucking understand that I hardly have a time to brush my hair or take a shower, and he's going to call me out on that, saying I don't love him enough, I want to go see a 1.5-hour movie. That's when it just all felt that part. I was like, wait a second, this is not love. This is not a God that cares about me. You know what I mean? It was just like this whole like, woo, and that's where everything
fantastic
up. And I started going back and looking at things. There was a lot of, yes, nothing makes sense. But in my case, there was just as much that started to make sense. It's just like, okay, wait a second. Yeah, this totally makes sense. For example, the Bible being like the word of, when I really started walking away from that blind faith, and I was like, this is a book that's been translated 100 times before it's gotten to where it is today. It's been under the nose of insane leaders of countries that wanted it translated such, and it's been through all of this, not to mention the people who even originally wrote these things were humans themselves. Like the woman, wear your veil, women should be covered in church. That was Paul's fucking, that was his problem with, he had problem with women, that guy, problem with women. And it was like, so all of a sudden, like all this stuff started to make sense to me. I was just like, yeah, why would I just completely plow down like rational thinking because some flawed, very flawed human being somewhere in the past wrote something down one day. It was wild. That did make a lot of sense to me. And also, yes, there was just so much that I lost too. Some of it was just losing time. Like I mourned the years that I was still in. Like stuff. Like that's what I was mourning. I was like, oh my God, all this time, all this life I could have had. Yes. That's one thing I for sure, really mourned. But I did have, also want to ask you one question, because especially for those of us leaving cults who are born into the cult, and you're coming out into a world that is extremely unfamiliar to you, and you don't know anything. And so a lot of times our connections in our cases are to our family, or are to our, that's the last connection you have, because you walked away from the cult. The only people who are personally connected to you are your family. But then you've got these, whether they're parents or siblings, in most cases, parents that are just these diehard believers still. Even if they're not in the cult anymore, a lot of our parents went from in the cult to a church or some other belief. And we see some of our counterparts ending up in this place where they have to accept or excuse things that happened in the past or things that are happening today, just to keep that connection, because you are so just like you're out in the middle of the ocean without a raft.
Yeah.
And that's the things that sometimes like I know that we've tried to hold on to, of like, how do I keep this connection with this person while also losing my religion.
Yeah, that's such a huge deal. And I think that the best that we can do is to begin trying to build our supportive secular community as best we can. And it's quite a bit of work. It's different. The cult or the church is a one-stop shop for everything. We have our emotional and psychological and sometimes financial needs met. There are people to babysit our kids each week within the church. Yes. So we have 2 hours away from them while we're in services or whatever. And we also have this big thing in common, this rule book. And so we believe that other people are going to treat us according to the same rule book. So building our life post-cult and post-religion, it ends up looking more like a patchwork quilt. So I have my hiking community, my kayaking community, my writing community, and I actually belong in the town I'm in. We have an atheist, skeptic, and humanist group that meets a couple times a month. And some of those folks grew up very religious and some never were religious at all. But that also feels like a safe place for me to get together and talk with people who are embracing reality. We have to work to be trying to build those communities, and they don't happen overnight. And we have to be careful because we're vulnerable. We're very vulnerable when we have suffered such tremendous loss as our worldview and our community. And so it's easy for us to get sucked in to another equally fundamentalist group. So we need to be careful. We need to be doing our research into cults and what makes a cult and becoming familiar with people like Dr. Yanya Lalich and Dr. Steve Haas and Rick Allen Ross. Those are the three that really come to mind. And of course, Dr. Winnell, Leaving the Fold, Recovering from Religion with Dr. Daryl Ray, plugging into those different communities and accessing the resources. So there's a lot of psychoeducation where we're educating ourselves to protect ourselves. And like I said earlier, as far as our parents go, sometimes there comes a point where that our need for authenticity, our need to be ourselves, outweighs our need for their acceptance. When we feel that we have enough of a supportive platform now with support from these other people, we're not quite as dependent on our parents to provide that anymore. And it still is, it really hurts when we recognize that our parents are never going to be who we want them to be. They're never going to be who we deserve or who we need them to be. They're just flawed humans, and they've been caught up in an untruth, basically, in a fantasy, a religious fantasy. And they are unable at this point to break themselves out of it. So if we want them to love us just as we are, we must love them just as they are. And sometimes for our own health and sanity, we do have to put some really good boundaries there, really firm boundaries. So maybe we don't have Christmas with them every year when it's they're demanding that we attend services and it's all going to be God this and Jesus that. Maybe we don't go there for that, or maybe we put a time limit on it. Oh, I can't attend Sunday morning, but I'll see you Christmas Eve, or I'll see you Boxing Day, or whatever it is. Giving ourselves permission to take whatever breaks we need. It's okay. And it's not up to us how our parents or how our loved ones react to our news and our liberation. That's up to them, and that's on them. Our part is just to be ourselves, to be kind and compassionate, to be honest with who we are and how we are. And it's up to them how they take it. And you don't have to tell them anything if you don't want to. It's yours. It's your news. It's your way of thinking. You can do with it what you will.
What about like opening a dialogue with the believer people in your family? Is that something that, is it better just to strive for, hey, let's just agree to disagree and love around those spaces? Or is there something that you would suggest for people that want to start a conversation and start going down that road?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think it's quite individual. And a lot of it depends on how strong you feel as the one who has left. Is it going to be really difficult and problematic to have those discussions or not? And a lot of times, because Christians, according to the Bible, they have to always be ready to give a reason for the hope that lies within them. In season, out of season, you have to be prepared to preach the gospel. And so then we leave and are still believing. Relatives and friends can be like, why? What reasons do you have? You have to show me right now. You have to prove. I'm sorry, but that's bullshit. I don't actually have to prove anything to you. All I'm doing is telling you, I don't believe that anymore. And so some people say, I don't believe it, and I welcome any respectful questions that you have. And then some people say, I don't believe it, and I do not want to talk about it again. It's going to damage our relationship irreparably. So from now on, if we want to maintain this relationship, that topic is off limits. But of course, then relationships tend to get very shallow.
Yeah.
Because the main thing we had in common was this really strong attachment to this fantasy. That wasn't reality. And so how can they talk to you about anything else? So then it's up to us to say, how's Uncle Stanley doing with the gout? Or how's so-and-so's kids doing this sort of thing? Or did you know I've started playing football or whatever? And trying to broaden the horizons of the relationship we have with that person. And if we're married to a believer, the switch has to move from the focus on shared beliefs to a focus on shared values. And I always encourage my clients as well who leave religion to do values clarification work. Do some exercises. They're all over the internet on values clarification. What is important to you now? Because when I was still religious, up highest on my values list would have been obedience, faith, chastity, this sort of thing. Now the highest is autonomy. I have to be autonomous. I have to be free and have the ability to make my own decisions and question and explore. So we can do some values clarification work and have our partner, our still religious partner, do some. And then we can see where they still align and where potentially they don't. And we can maybe do something. We can find activities that are in alignment with those values. Okay, we're going to be volunteering together at the soup kitchen. Or, okay, we both value being in good physical shape. Let's start training for a marathon or whatever. That would not be me. But let's start training for something that we can do together. So you really have to be looking and searching for things since you don't have that one main thing in common anymore. And it is possible for some people to retain those relationships, not easy, but possible. And for other people, it would just be too much work. And so they're able to let the other person go in a peaceful way. The problem, of course, can come up when very religious spouse or grandparents really want to grab those children and indoctrinate those children without our consent. So then sometimes the best we can do when we have access to the children is to be trying to train them in critical thought from the time they're very small. So you're going to read them creation myths from around the world, from all these different cultures, and say, everybody loves stories and every people group has a story, and Christianity is a story. It's a story, grandma and grandpa, really, it's their favorite story, but it's just a story. Or you're watching cartoons with them and Superman takes off and he's flying in the air and you're going to be saying, wow, that looks like so much fun. Do you know anyone that could fly? Do you think people could fly? And so you're getting them to think and always encouraging our children to bring questions to us and work. It doesn't matter how silly they might think the question is, it's not going to be silly to us. We're going to take it seriously and we're going to find out. If we don't know the answer, we're going to help them, show them where to look and how they can find the answer so that they know they can always come and talk to us about these things. That's the best way that I've found so far to try and navigate co-parenting or situations with in-laws and grandparents that are challenging. I'm giving up all my secrets here.
That's good advice. That's really great advice. It is.
That's really good advice.
That's basically what I did with my daughter. My parents started to indoctrinate her and give her Bibles and show her all those videos and whatnot. And she came back and I said, you can believe whatever you like. I've chosen not to believe that. It's basically what I told them. You can believe whatever you want. And within 2 weeks, she was like, this is stupid. I can't believe this. What about that? She did exactly that. She started thinking, nice. Thinking critically for herself. And she realized yes. on her own that it was just basically an invisible support system.
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. Very well done. I think particularly where it can be extra hard is folks who live in the southern United States, where one of the first questions you're asked when you move to a new community is what church are you going to or where do you worship? Which is like such a super invasive and unacceptable question to ask mm-hmm. somebody. But then if you have children in that situation, and then there's Christian after school clubs or Good Sam Club or whatever they call it. And it's just further ways to indoctrinate children. And they're not going to be invited to so-and-so's birthday party if parents find out that you're an atheist, because atheists yeah. eat babies or whatever the right. whatever sort of nonsense they're believing. So that can be a little trickier to navigate. Yeah. I typically say, like, my belief is that it's good and healthy when I'm in a situation, in a public situation, and someone is assuming that I share their religious beliefs or in public or whatever, for me to say, actually, I don't believe that at all. And I think that evidence points in the opposite direction. People, if they're in their bubble, they don't hear that from anyone. So those of us outside the bubble, it makes sense if we're safe to say, no, I totally disagree. Mm-hmm. And to stand our ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to do sometimes.
Oh my gosh, so much easier said than done. Yes, I absolutely recognize that. But I feel right now in the United States, wow, just being in Canada, watching,
oh,
it's
Lord.
Like a, it's like a fight for your nation's democracy.
Yeah.
And Christian nationalists are the ones responsible yeah. for tearing it all apart. So it's really important for folks to get out and vote.
Oh yes. My gosh.
Yes. I just think about it. I'm like, well, you know, I stood my ground with no problem when I was a Christian. No matter who came at me or what they came at me with, I stood my ground. So mm-hmm. why shouldn't I do the same thing now? Mm-hmm. What you believe is yes. what you believe.
Yeah. Yeah. I support you in that.
Not that I'm doing it yet.
I sometimes look to my LGBTQ friend, one very dear friend who left the country altogether, left the continent so that they could live who they are. Without any trouble. They could just go there and everyone who met them just, oh, this is the way this person is. There wasn't pressure from the family or anything like that. And sometimes, yeah, things are serious enough that people just feel like they need a brand new start. And then their family becomes the friends and the people they choose to surround themselves with, mm-hmm. because the people that raised you are just the people that raised you. Remember, they're in your life by invitation only. It is possible to start over. It takes a lot of support and a lot of fortitude and giving yourself permission to do
it. Does. Yeah, absolutely.
It's fantastic. It's been really mm-hmm. wonderful talking to you. You're such a nice, accepting person. It's so beautiful to see.
Thank you very much. This has really been a pleasure for me as well. And I invite your listeners, if they're interested in the Shameless Sexuality Life After Purity Culture Conference, they can go to shamelesssexuality.org and they can get a ticket there. And if they go on YouTube, they can search Conference on Religious Trauma. And that's where I'll be posting the video of my podcast. I'm going to do video and it'll also be split into audio. So it'll be available on pretty much every audio platform as well. Nice. They can also watch it and watch the videos from the older conferences on religious trauma on the YouTube channel.
That's fantastic.
Perfect.
It's amazing. You're doing great things.
Oh, thank you. I better say the one last thing that I don't want to forget. If people are looking for one-on-one religious recovery work, they can go to my website, which is divorcing-religion.com. divorcing-religion.com. That's where they can learn more about me, and they can book me right there through the website.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think anybody would be very privileged to be able to talk to you about this kind of stuff, especially if they're just new and deconstructing. We'll include all your info in the show notes too.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And then maybe someday we could be on your podcast too.
That I would love that. I think that would just be terrific.
Thank you so much, Janice.
Thank you.
End it like we always do. Stay brave. And remember that every butterfly was once a caterpillar.
That's so wonderful.